Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Say Why to Drugs. Thanks again to everyone who's come along to book events, who's bought the book or left reviews on Amazon. It's still on 100% 5 stars there, which is really amazing. And if you want to add to that, well, that would be delightful. More live events are coming up, including a live podcast this Saturday at Vault Festival in London about sex and drugs. And that one is going to be, I'm really excited about that. The guest is going to be Alex Aldridge, and it's going to be brilliant. So if you can, tickets are still available. Have a look online, you can find them. Also, the following weekend, the 14th, a talk at Glasgow's I Write Literary Festival. So I think tickets are available for that as well. But to today's episode. This one is, as you may have noticed, a long one. And the reason for that is that it's an interview with Twitter's secret drug addict. I thought about editing it down to make it a bit shorter, but really there was nothing in the conversation that I wanted to remove. A few trigger warnings before we start. The conversation, as you might imagine, covers drug use and contains swearing. It also covers topics including psychosis and witnessing someone die after taking drugs. As this is a long episode, I'll leave it there, but I really hope that you enjoy this conversation between myself and the secret drug addict.
I am the secret drug addict.
Cool. So I guess probably the best place to start is what's a secret drug addict?
It's an account I run on social media, so I'm on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, and essentially it's just a platform to kind of talk about addiction, mental health, and kind of, you know, offer support and signposting to people that might be affected by those issues.
So I'm guessing your name means that you consider yourself a drug addict?
I do, yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about kind of your history and your experiences with drugs? And so you stopped using drugs.
I stopped using drugs
7 years ago?
No, 12th of June 2007.
2007, that's where I got the 7 from, sorry. So tell us a little bit about your kind of drug use and why you started using drugs, why you carried on using drugs, when you realised you had a problem with drugs. I mean, this is a big, broad question.
Yeah, there's a lot in there to cover. I started using drugs, I suppose, around the age of 11 or 12. You know, we were smoking hash and drinking.
And it's something like you and your friends kind of...
Yeah, we were doing it, you know, after school at lunchtime, you know, going back into school kind of stoned, you know, after 6 of us sharing, like, you know, one joint between us or something. And, it was fun. Did drugs because I found, you know, life was kind of boring, I suppose, and drugs made it fun. And took your inhibitions away, made you feel, made you feel more connected to what was going on, I suppose.
So 11 or 12 seems maybe young for use. Were you using drugs quite regularly then, or?
I suppose quite regularly. I mean, you know, every Friday lunchtime we had double PE Friday afternoon. So every Friday lunchtime we'd go to my friend's house who lived over the road from the school, and we would drink, we'd have like little shots of absolute vodka and, put CDs on and listen to music and just like, you know, mess around for our lunch and then go to kind of PE. pissed, I suppose. Yeah, well, yeah, drunk, you know. I remember there was a few times drinking on the way to school, you know, so turning up in assembly drunk. And I think, you know, I think part of it was I liked the attention, you know, being the kid that was like drunk and was a bit sort of, you know, I suppose rock and roll, like, you know, just having something that separated me from everybody else was, you know, it made me an individual and it made me feel different or special. And I kind of liked that attention, you know, as well, which, you know, on reflection, I suppose, isn't healthy. But looking back, was I young? I suppose. I mean, I've got a child now who's a year or two older than that. And he's, you know, the idea of him drinking or doing drugs, like, you know, he's incredibly young. Do you know what I mean? He's very, you know, I think I was a year older than him when I'd left school. I'm looking at him now going, this boy, he's not even equipped for school, let alone life, you know. So, yeah, I think it was, you know, but people around me, there was older kids from the youth club that were smoking, you know, smoking hash, and, you know, there wasn't any hard drugs that I knew of that, you know, around me. My parents didn't really drink or do drugs at that time, so it wasn't culturally, you know, I wasn't steeped in it. It was something I think that I made an effort to seek.
And so you say you left school fairly soon after that.
And then what did you
go on to do?
Well, I ended up in a women's refuge with my mum when I was like 13 in Wales. So I ended up leaving London and going to this village in Wales, which was a real culture shock. And I sort of came back after about 6 months and went to live with my dad. And he just didn't bother sort of enrolling me in school, or, you know, he was busy working, just getting on with his life. We were kind of like flatmates. And I had, you know, I didn't make any effort to, you know, I wouldn't have even known how to have gone about trying to get into find a school and, you know, get into it. So I just started working, basically. I'd recently started going to nightclubs at that time. I was spending a lot of time in pubs and nightclubs with kids that were, I was like 13, 14. They were, the youngest were probably 17, 18. You know, a few of their older friends were in their early 20s. So I was kind of hanging about with these guys that are older than me. So, you know, I'd be in the pub in the corner, they'd buy the drinks and, you know, stuff like that. And I ended up working at a nightclub, doing just flyering, just standing outside clubs at 2 o'clock in the morning, handing out bits of paper. And it was quite a cool indie club. It was it was in the West End. And it was one of those nightclubs that kind of, you know, that lots of musicians went to, lots of music journalists. So it was a kind of an industry nightclub as opposed to...
For punters.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, you'd be in the toilet and you'd have, you know, one of the guys from Blur would be in there, and you'd have one of the guys from Ride, or, you know, all these kind of shoegaze and indie bands.
So was this like early 90s?
This was like 92.
Yeah.
Around 1992, and, you know, Kurt Cobain, around 91, Kurt Cobain, if he was in London, he would come down and stuff, and it was just a real cool kind of hangout. And once I kind of got involved in that, that was it. That was kind of what I wanted to be in, was like music and hang out with musicians and stuff. So the idea of sort of education, or, you know, was completely out the window at that point.
At this point, you were what, in your kind of mid-teens, I guess?
14, maybe.
Yeah. So... I was going to ask, do you think your drug use was a problem then? But obviously that's still really young, and like it's a problem for people that young to be using drugs for lots of reasons in terms of kind of development, markers for behavioural problems. But in terms of your day-to-day life, where did the drugs fit in?
I at the time there was absolutely no problem. You know, I was doing drugs, I was staying up most of the night, or, you know, till 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, sleep until lunchtime, you know, and just repeating it every day, basically. I remember at one point around the age of sort of 15 or 16, we were looking at the clubs we were going to and stuff. And I was thinking we were going to 10 or 11 nightclubs a week, You know, we would sort of, you know, we'd jump in a car and we'd maybe hit two or three nightclubs in one night and stuff. And because we were kind of working, you know, I was in the music industry and we'd get in free everywhere. So it wasn't costing us anything. You know, you could do 2-3 hours sleep, stay up all night, go to work. You could, you know, I was kind of elasticated still at that point. So I would, yeah, it was never a problem. Looking back now, I didn't develop emotionally. I developed quite bad sleeping habits. You know, I don't have the best coping skills for life. There were lots of negatives in that sense. I didn't pursue education, you know, which at the time you don't understand. But, you know, when you're focused on just music and drugs and, you know, chasing girls, there's a lot of life stuff that passes you by. And then you kind of come out of it the other side and you're kind of like, I don't know what happened.
But it's a long way between the early 90s and 2007 when you stopped using drugs. So kind of what happened in that between time? Were things good for a long time? Or like when did you start to think that you had a problem?
Do you know what? I don't think things were ever really good. You know, people sort of say to me, oh, you must have had so much fun. And when you go, well, yeah, you know, I was very lucky and I did some fantastic things and met some really interesting people and, you know, had some of these amazing experiences. But the flip side of that is I spent a lot of time suicidal. I spent a lot of time sabotaging relationships. I spent a lot of time being asked to clear my desk and leave, you know, trying to get myself sectioned because I felt like I was going mental. And, you know, for all the good times, there was lots of bad times as well. And I don't think, you know, you don't end up in places like women's refuges and the stuff that occurred before that, you know, in my sort of family and afterwards without, you know, picking up some baggage that I never really kind of addressed, you know. But, yeah, it was essentially, it was manageable, you know. It was kind of drugs and fun and the odd problem. And then I got into working at Sony when I think I was maybe 16 or something, and was just completely overwhelmed with it. Just emotionally, I couldn't handle being there. I had quite a big office. I had a secretary. I had an expense account. I'm flying around the country watching bands and staying in Hilton hotels. And it was, I love staying in hotels. I do kind of enjoy that, the anonymity that comes with that. But by the same token, it can be quite lonely. So you find yourself drinking or, you know, trying to talk, you know, just going out, just trying to meet people and stuff. And I didn't really understand at the time that how lonely a lot of those experiences were, as well as them kind of, there was kind of fun and glamour involved maybe. Yeah. And then from there, I ended up working at Creation Records. I ended up now I'm working with Oasis. I'm working with Primal Scream, the Super Furry Animals and all these kind of huge indie bands. And, my drug use kind of increased with that. And I ended up splitting up with the girlfriend I was seeing at the time. And I just couldn't really cope with it. And then at that point, this was around 98, my sort of drug use became a real coping mechanism. I think it'd always been a low level stuff. But now it was like, you know, that's all it was being used for. And my drug use was kind of at this point it increased as I'd got older exponentially anyway through my teenage years. But at that point it was basically sort of daily. And you know, the dream of kind of always wanting to work in the music industry and sleep with lots of women and do lots of drugs, it was a kind of like a, you know, like a three-pronged dream, was now just, it was just drugs really. That was all I was kind of interested in. Do you know what I mean? Women would just kind of get in the way. You might have to share your drugs with them, which I was never really, at that point I kind of wasn't really keen on it. Do you know what I mean? I'd rather just do them on my own. You know, I'd be going and watching bands for work, and you know, I'd travel across London to watch a band. Within 6 or 7 minutes I'm out the door, gone. You know, it's taken me 40 minutes to get there, but I just had to go, and you know, I had to be there. You know, so just everything kind of became secondary to my drug use, and my, you know, work suffered as a consequence. And having a drug, a big drug, I'd say drug problem or, you know, heavy drug use is kind of okay as long as you're doing your job. People will accept it as long as you're making their money. At the point when you're not making their money or you're turning up for work, you know, I'd turn up and I'd have cut my, you know, my arms would be cut up from the night before. I'd been sort of psychosis and self-harming and, you know, hadn't had much sleep, and, you know, I've got, you know, my arms are, you know, they're scabbing up and there's sort of dried blood on me, and I'm, you know, I'm maybe 20 years old. And I just think that must have been terrifying. I mean, it was a different time, and I think now I'd like to think that, you know, HR would want to have a chat with me and support me through it. But at the time, there wasn't really kind of HR departments, especially in the music industry, and they certainly weren't sort of geared up, I don't think, to dealing with kind of the chaos of adolescent children.
Well, I mean, I've read books about Creation Records, and it seems like you weren't the only person living that kind of life necessarily in that. Well, I mean, I use that record label as an example,
but in the music industry,
I mean, more broadly, do you think
Creation embraced it? Creation embraced being the outsider, being the rock and roll outsider that was chaotic and caused trouble, and, you know, was very punk rock. I think within that, though, there were people that would, you know, they would use drugs, they would behave in that way, but they knew where to draw the line. You know, these are people that are still working today, that have worked constantly, through the 80s, 90s, 2000s, whatever. You know, some of them have become sober, maybe. Some of them haven't. Some, you know, as they've got older, I think they've naturally, a lot of them have just calmed down in their drinking and drug use, as you do when you become old. But I think that I took it to a sort of level that they didn't, you know what I mean? They were maybe heavy users. This is like addiction. I was an addiction, which I think are slightly different things.
Sure, yeah. And do you think, though, that being in the music industry made it that bit harder? Do you think it was more, drugs were more available? It was more kind of condoned or even encouraged? Or do you think that's... Because I think a lot of people who don't work in the music industry have that idea of it. And do you think there's much truth in that?
I think it's more available. I mean, you know, the estate I grew up in, you know, drugs was available. That's where I used to get the drugs from. Do you know what I mean? It's a big, let me just call my dealer. I'd be like, I'll call my pal and see if he's around. My friends were sold drugs. You know, people I grew up with, everybody was involved on some level. You know, were drugs available? I mean, yeah, one of the reasons I got into the music industry, I wanted to work in the industry, was because I wanted to do drugs. I didn't want to get up and do a 9-to-5 job in an estate agent's or you know, work at, you know, on the checkout at Tesco's. I wanted to meet women. I wanted to work in a creative industry in and around music, and I wanted to do loads of drugs and stay up all night. I mean, that's why else would you get into the music industry? I mean, that's the dream. I grew up reading these books from, you know, bands like Led Zeppelin or Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, The Happy Mondays. You know, these were this was the dream.
And when was there a particular moment when you realised that you needed to stop, or was it a gradual thing? So how did that? Because I think a lot of people, when they start to go down a path of starting to use more and more, starting to rely on a substance as a coping mechanism or as a crutch more and more, It can be a really sort of gradual.
Yeah, it's very insidious. It's very it's a very slow, insidious kind of illness. I mean, I in 1998, I found a letter the other day, actually, maybe 6-7 months ago. I found a letter from my GP, you know, where I tried to engage with drug services in 1998. So I was maybe 19 or 20 or something. I don't know. Because I knew that my relationship with drugs wasn't right. That I had friends that were degenerate drug users, but they still went home. You know, I would stay up for 3 days. I'd stay up for 5 days. I would, you know, I'd be getting warnings at work, and I wouldn't listen. I ended up losing the job. It was a great job. I loved that job. It, you know, relationships. She was great. I was really happy with her. She left. You know, this was like a constant with me. Whereas my friends would maybe have low level consequences, but they were not as drastic as mine. They didn't, I don't think they obsessed about drugs as much as me, and they certainly didn't do as much as me. Although they were quite capable of going out on a Friday and not coming home till Sunday. You know, that wouldn't be every weekend, maybe. You know, and at least they went home and sort of got to sleep before going to work on Monday. I'd still be out Sunday night and just not going to work on Monday. Or worse, I'd turn up. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So, you know, I'd known for a very long time that I had a problem, but I thought, I didn't understand what addiction was. I thought that I was just doing too much, or I just, you know, I was greedy. Maybe that was the problem. The problem was I was greedy. So, you know, or that I'd built up a tolerance. So the reason I have to stay up for 5 days pumping myself full of drugs is because I've now built up a tolerance. That's the problem. See, so what I need to do is if I stop doing that drug and start doing this drug for a little bit instead, my tolerance to that drug will drop, and I can go back at some point to use it like I initially did at the beginning when it was fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then what happens is I just end up addicted to two drugs. And then so I go, you know, we need to stay in the house because every time we go out, we're ended up in trouble. So what we'll do is we'll just take Valium for a while. And then that will sort us out because we'll do a little deed. And it just, I ended up just, you know, trying to find this kind of balance, like some sort of mad chemist. If I do just enough of this substance mixed with just enough of that substance with a little bit of this on top, everything will be perfect and I'll be okay. And that wasn't my experience. That never happened. So occasionally I would have these breaks or I'd switch drugs, and life would maybe improve a little bit. You know, when I was staying in the house, just chain smoking skunk and taking Valium, you know, drinking red wine, there was a period where, you know, I wasn't self-harming, I wasn't staying awake for 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. I was sleeping a lot, I was eating, so I put a bit of weight on. So you start to feel better about yourself. So you go, actually, you know, I'm not that bad anymore. And then you kind of end up sort of, you know, getting yourself into trouble and you get that bad again. And then, you know, so I went around and around in circles with it for a while, and but didn't really know where to go. So I'm going to drug services and, you know, I've got a counsellor there and stuff, and, you know, they're offering me rehab, and I'm kind of like, well, I can't stop smoking skunk. That's not a problem. Not seeing that, you know, staying in the house and, you know, never going out, that, you know, not seeing that as a consequence, not seeing that as a negative.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, I haven't got a problem with that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm getting older and life's passing me by, but at least I'm not staying out for 5 days. So I didn't want to go to rehab because it was, you know, total abstinence, and the idea of total abstinence was just absolutely terrifying. And so I'd sort of bounce in and out of counselling, and, you know, what we did, we just talk about, you know, what a dick my dad was, or, you know, my issues with my mum. And I think, you know, going to counselling when you maybe haven't had drugs that morning, but, you know, I've been taking drugs constantly for, you know, that whole week, the week before, you know, for, you know, daily.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I walk out of there being so upset and you know, emotionally sort of uncomfortable, that the first thing I do would be like roll a joint or have a drink and just suppress that stuff. Yeah. So I never really dealt with anything, you know, any feelings I had would just get suppressed kind of instantly because they were too uncomfortable. So I don't think any of the therapy ever really worked, because I wasn't in a space to where it would resonate with me or I could connect, mm-hmm. like emotionally with it. So I'd sort of managed between 2000 and 2005. I'd kind of, you know, so I was sort of juggling stuff. I was having these kind of these breaks of certain drugs and doing ones that were less harmful. And in 2005, it just all started to unravel again. And then in 2006, one of my flatmates ended up stabbing his mum in crack psychosis, ended up murdering his mum. You know, it was in the paper. It was like a pretty big deal, as it would be, do you know what I mean? It was in the national newspapers, in the local newspapers. You know, this was a guy that I'd sit, you know, we'd be sitting up at 2 a.m, you know, doing drugs, and he'd be telling me about all the horrific things he'd seen in the Falklands and all this kind of stuff, right? And then, you know, 2 months later, he stabbed his dad. His dad, the only reason his dad survived, because his dad lay down next to his wife who was dead and pretended that he was dead. That was the only reason, you know, it was just madness. So, you know, that happened. And a girl died on my front room floor. Like a house party, just a bunch of us all hanging out doing drugs, and you know, she did a big line of coke, and she went into respiratory failure, and she died at my feet, and you know, everyone left, as you would do. Everyone panicked, and everyone was wrapping their drugs, and it was getting off. You know, I had someone, you know, stand outside, and you know, wait for the ambulance. You know, I've gone out, they've got off. You know, so it kind of just left me and one other person there, and you know, for like 10 minutes waiting for this ambulance, and I'm sitting there doing drugs, just kind of with this body, just, you know, like 4 or 5 foot away from me. And, it was, sometimes I'm quite blasé about it in the sense of it factually happened. Other times I kind of connect to it, and you have these moments where it's like fucking hell, this was like, this ain't what, it weren't supposed to be like this. I thought I was going to be like David Geffen, or I thought I was going to, you know, play up front for Arsenal. I thought I was going to, you know, do some stuff. I wasn't expecting to be around this kind of carnage. You know, this is not the sort of life that I had planned for myself. So, yeah, so I this kind of happened in a very short space of time, and I bumped into somebody in the street, and I think I was smoking a joint, and I was emotional. I was crying off and on, and I was just roaming around the streets, and I had my hood up, and I'm not looking anyone in the eye, and then I bumped into a pal, and he sort of said, "Oh, you know, how's it going? What are you up to?" And I just kind of broke down and said, "You know, I can't do this no more. I can't cope with this." And he didn't say anything else to me. He just got on his phone, and he's ironically enough, he's a friend of mine that sells drugs, and he's like rung somebody up, and he was always kind of, you know, when you're in that. When you sell drugs, you're always making private phone calls in the corner, you know. So he's like stepped away from me. He's on the phone. I'm like crying, just waiting for him to get off the phone. I think this is kind of inappropriate. I've just bared my soul here and got really kind of honest with you. And then he's put the phone down and gone, "Right, I'm taking you to a meeting." And I didn't really know what he was talking about, but I was lonely. You know, he's always got skunk on him. He's always got drugs on him. I'm going to just hang out with him. Mm-hmm. And he's driven me to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting and sat in this meeting with me. And, you know, I'm sat in this meeting, you know, stoned and listening to the guy talking. And I had no experience of 12-step, you know, 12-step groups, self-help groups. I was kind of aware of AA as an institution. I understood that there was a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where alcoholics went. But again, you know, my idea of an alcoholic was a park bench drunk, you know, and if you weren't a homeless street drunk, then are you really an alcoholic? Probably not. But Narcotics Anonymous, certainly I had absolutely no idea that it was like even a thing. I thought people go to rehab, they come out of rehab and they're better, and that's the end of it. And, just in this meeting, I just heard people talking about, you know, when they stopped, they couldn't stay stopped. When they started, they couldn't stop. When they, you know, when they did have brief periods of abstinence, they were obsessing about using again and unhealthy relationships and all this stuff. And I just kind of got it. In that moment, I realised that I wasn't alone. Whereas before, when I was been doing drugs with all my friends, I'd be like, you know, they're not the same as me. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Well, I'm different. I'm weird. There's something wrong with me. There's something kind of broken. And being in this meeting, I kind of realised. I just kind of got it. I suddenly understood what addiction was. And I've not used drugs since that first meeting, really. I mean, yeah. And that was like the 12th of June, 2007.
Thank you so much for sharing your story. Because I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast, and certainly me as a researcher, you spend so long thinking about the sort of the facts and the numbers that actually the personal stories that kind of resonate you don't necessarily get so much, so it's really amazing to kind of hear it so sort of matter-of-factly, I suppose. So can you tell us a little bit now about when did you set up Secret Drug Addict, and what was your kind of thinking behind using social media, for want of a better phrase, to talk about these kind of things?
Set the Secret Drug Addict up 2 years ago, I think, you know, 25 months ago or something. Basically, just as a sort of reaction to, you know, the cuts, the austerity cuts in the addiction and kind of mental health services, really. I mean, I'd hate to be trying to stop using drugs now. In the current climate, I don't know if I'd find the help. I don't know if the help's available. I really don't. It's, you know, there was quite a lot when I got, you know, when I was looking for help, and I don't think, you know, a lot of the rehabs are now shut down. A lot of the funding's gone. It's I think it's a tough time. I think abstinence in itself is incredibly difficult. I think, you know, I mean, you're probably know more than me the exact figure of people that are able to maintain kind of abstinence. You know, I'm led to believe it's somewhere around 5% of people that go into recovery maintain long-term recovery. So it's not a great number of people. And that, you know, and those were numbers that were based on all the help that was available, being able to maybe go to funded rehab maybe two or three times. I had friends that it maybe took them four or five times before they got clean and got jobs and paid taxes and became contributing members of society. Whereas you're lucky if you get, you know, one trip paid for now. So it's, so it's incredibly difficult, I think. So, yes, I set it up thinking, you know, there's a sort of a gap in the market. It was something that I'd spoken to with Neville Southall about. And we'd been speaking and seen, you know, and he'd kind of come up with the idea that his social media platform, he has like 155,000 people or something, whatever. You know, so, but he has a decent following. Mm-hmm. That could be used to connect with people that are maybe struggling and maybe don't know where to go. Or, you know, just want to someone to communicate with, to maybe bounce stuff off. Maybe, you know, how do you think I've got a problem because I do this, this and this, or, you know, whatever. So we started it up for that. And it's kind of took off. It's doing all right. It keeps me busy. It keeps me too busy, if I'm honest.
So how does it work then? Do you sort of trawl Twitter looking for people who need help, or do you kind of hope that people will find you? And I think we should also talk about the work that you do with Neville as well, because that's really, really interesting. But in terms of Secret Drug Addict, you share quite a lot of articles, for example, but do people take a lot of conversations like offline with you and that?
Yeah,
kind of thing?
I get lots of messages. I say lots, I don't know what the barometer is for lots, but I get, you know, maybe 30, sometimes more messages a week of people, you know, inboxing me. I certainly don't go trawling Twitter, bothering people about their substance use. You know, there's nothing worse than someone who's busy, do you know what I mean? You know, if people are doing drugs and there's no negative impacts and it's working in their lives, then, you know, carry on. As long as no one's getting hurt, it's nothing to do with me. If, on the other hand, you're drinking or you're doing drugs and there's consequences and you're unable to stop, or you want to talk about that, then I'm available to kind of, you know, have a chat, support, signpost, share my experiences, you know, whatever.
And so with Neville, you manage his, so he does Twitter takeovers.
Yes.
Very regularly, and you kind of manage
we
those.
Try and do a couple a week. So initially it started off with just me doing it, and that seemed to work really well. And then Neville kind of, you know, thought, you know, there were some other topics that he was kind of interested in around, you know, mental health stuff, you know, sex workers' rights. I think they were initially the kind of three that we did. So we thought, you know, it's working with my platform. Why would it not work for others? And since then, we've kind of expanded it to basically anyone that's doing anything kind of positive, I suppose. I mean, the process is that sometimes Neville will find stuff himself that he's kind of passionate about, and we'll tell them to contact me. Otherwise, I will just, you know, as when you're on social media, you come across people's pages, you come across charity pages, you know, campaigners' pages. And if what they're doing looks like it's, you know, it's positive and it looks like it's,
the word worthy is springing to my head, but that's probably not the right word.
Well, just you have to be careful, because there's a lot of people go, I'm a campaigner. And then you're kind of going, oh, great. And then, you know, they spend most of their time arguing or being confrontational on social media. They don't have, you know, because they maybe are not part of a, you know, they've had no comms training, or they haven't got, you know, great people skills. I don't know. You know, there's lots of reasons. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we want to do is platform somebody that's going to behave in a way that maybe isn't beneficial to their cause, you know, drags Neville into some sort of controversy. So we try to make sure that they are, you know, even if it's a campaigner or whatever, that they're professional with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'll say to Neville, you know, we've got, what about these? I'll send him a list of who I'm sort of recommending. And then he rarely says no, because they're always good causes.
Yeah.
And then he'll say, yeah. And he'll give me a little thumbs up emoji. And then I'll contact them. And, you know, if they're interested, which generally they are, I think we've only had one or two turn us down. We'll work out, you know, when works for them and for us, and sort of plan it that way. So, you know, it's becoming a full-time job, which in itself is, you know, because obviously it's all unpaid. No one, you know, Neville doesn't get paid, I don't get paid, no one gets paid. But yeah, but trying to keep on top of everything. So, you know, I'm talking to the food bank, the Trussell Trust. I always get that wrong, Trussell Trust. You know, trying to get them on in the next week or two for, you know, to try and raise stuff for Christmas.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So there's all that kind of stuff, which, you know, so I try and work out of Canada what's going on, you know, what awareness weeks, months or days are coming up, who would be appropriate for those, you know, how can we help these different organisations in the best way that, you know, that benefits them. So it can be very time consuming, but, you know, it's I enjoy it. I love it. I love it. It's a fantastic opportunity to kind of try and put something positive back into, you know, into the world, I think, without sounding too kind of, you know, romantic and like a dick.
I think the world needs it, and I think Twitter needs it sometimes as well.
I mean,
a lot of power to you.
You know, people talk a lot about, you know, social media and, you know, how it's negative and bad for their mental health. I mean, I tend not to follow too many people on there, so my feed is quite
curated.
Yes,
yeah.
you know, and also, I'm so self-consumed, I don't really care what's on. You know, I don't care what anyone's doing. This, like, how many likes have I got today? You know, but so being able to, you know, when someone talks about, oh, it's such a negative thing, I think mine's great. Yeah. I mean, we've, you know, I've got the Trestle Trust on, we've got we've had, you know, Women's Aid on next week, we've got, you know, NARCOA, you know, whoever it is, these fantastic organisations. And being able to, you know, if I think, the other thing I love about it as well is that, you know, I've got no idea how many people I've potentially helped, you know, which is fantastic for my ego, because, you know, like coming up to the election, we were like, right, let's try and get some Labour voices on to campaign, because I genuinely don't think this country can survive another Tory government, right? So I said to my wife, me and Neville organising some Labour Twitter takeovers. I said, you know, I'm gonna oust the Tories, and I'm sort of, if it happens, I'm taking responsibility for this, you know, like, so it's great for my ego, because I do, you know, I have to watch my ego, that I don't know who I'm helping. I don't know how many people I'm helping. And that's not, the numbers aren't important. Do you know what I mean? And I find a lot of humility. That's one of the reasons why my account is anonymous. You know, the main one is that, you know, people go, oh, you know, is it because of the stigma of addiction? I say, no, everybody knows I'm a junkie. Everybody knows I'm an addict. They knew when I was using. They know that I'm not now. I mean, it's not a secret. You know, I maybe don't walk into job interviews or, you know, go on, you know, lead with it on dates. You know, the first thing I say is when I'm sitting down with, you know, opposite somebody is, oh, you know, I'm a degenerate drug user. You know, it's not what I lead with. But everybody knows. And if it comes up in conversation, I'm quite happy to kind of, you know, discuss it. But what I wanted was, I wanted to be able to keep a little bit of control over how I tell it, who I tell. And also as well, I didn't want to be defined by it, like, oh, there's, you're that guy that spends his day talking about drugs. You know, I do spend probably too much time talking about drugs, but, you know, and I am a drug addict, but, you know, I have, you know, like we were saying earlier, you know, I have lots of other faults, you know, lots of other flawed character what's it, you know. Let's not just focus on the fact that I'm an addict. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the other reason is for my humility and my ego, you know, because I meet people and I say to them, oh, I do stuff with Neville. They go, oh, I've seen it. And I say, oh, yeah, I'm the secret driver. They go, oh, that's you. And I'm like, you know, I'm like Twitter famous. and that's no good for me. Do you know what I mean? The fact that I'm kind of anonymous, it's like I'm Twitter famous, but no one knows who I am. And that just helps keep me, my ego and my arrogance kind of right size. Do you know what I mean? And that's I find that very helpful, especially kind of from my own personal recovery. Mm-hmm. You know,
so you mentioned stigma there, and it's something that I'm really interested in from a sort of, because obviously I do research in this area, and it's something that's really important to me, and I'm really worried and angry about the cuts that are happening to drug services and that kind of thing. But how much of a role do you think stigma plays in that, and how much of a role do you think it plays in people avoiding sort of seeking help? That's a bit of a double question.
Yeah, I'd say huge. I mean, firstly, you know, people seeking help. You know, alcohol is fine. You know, if you've got an alcohol problem, then that's kind of, that's not too bad. I mean, I say it's fine. For some people, it's not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
if we had to grade, you know, substance problems,
yeah,
alcohol is the the one that you can, you know, go to HR at work and say, do you know what, I'm struggling. Or you can go to your GP and say, I think I'm drinking too much.
Because there's less of a moral judgment if you use alcohol, because it's so socially acceptable that everyone does it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't sort of see any difference between alcohol and drugs. I mean, it is a drug as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah,
you know, as I say, I've got no problem with people doing drugs. So it's not like, oh, it's a drug, like it's coming from a judgmental place. It's a fact.
It has the same effects on your body and brain as drugs, because it is one.
Yeah. So, you know, when I sometimes will tweet up how many days since I last used drugs, like 4,500 or something now, right? And I will say it's been so many days since I last took drugs, including alcohol, because for a lot of people they assume drugs and alcohol. And I sometimes say drugs and alcohol when I'm talking about them, but you know, but what that does is, I suppose, is subtly that kind of separates the two. When there is no separation, they are both, they're drugs. You know, cocaine, alcohol are drugs. It's, you know, or crack or heroin, you know, they're drugs. So I think that, you know, I, you know, I've worked in the kind of entertainment industry, and I'm you know, I've got some friends that I suppose are famous, and you know, I get to mix in some kind of interesting circles, and I know quite a lot of people that you would consider famous, I suppose, that are in recovery. And you know, I've seen articles in newspapers when they're talking about, but they've sort of come clean about their use. Only refer to alcohol when I know that they take drugs as well. But what they don't want is this: if you come out in newspapers and say, you know, if you're a BBC One presenter and you're an alcoholic, that's kind of okay. People go, oh, I understand he's got himself into trouble with alcohol. If they're, you know, if they're smoking crack, or you're like Richard Bacon, who was on, you know, Blue Peter, doing coke, that's not somehow okay. That's not okay. Do you know what I mean? And you know, and I think that I understand why people do that. You know, because they've got careers, and you know, they've got a public perception that they don't want to kind of damage, but I don't think that helps the general public. I don't think that helps the person on the street that's maybe, you know, got issues around with substances or, you know, drugs, whatever. But, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, no, I think that there is a... It's acceptable to be an alcoholic within reason. Do you know what I mean? You know, or it's not, maybe not acceptable, it's understood.
Understandable, yeah.
It's understood, right? But anything else is kind of... It's not... And more so, I think that with alcohol, I say there's like a sense of empathy. Whereas with drugs, it's kind of, you know, it's your own fault. Well, I'm not drugs because they're all drugs. Street drugs, right? It's your own fault. You did it to yourself.
You chose to do this illegal thing, and so therefore...
Well, you know, I chose to do drugs. I chose to drink. Yeah. I mean, I went to the pub. I was in a pub with... There was 200 other people in the pub that were all drinking. How did I know that I was going to end up with a, you know, with an issue? I didn't know. You know, it's the thing about addiction is that you don't understand you're addicted until you can't stop. You know, it's like I've got allergies. I'm allergic to penicillin, so it's quite clear what happens if I take penicillin. If it had been the same with alcohol, then I wouldn't have drunk the second time.
Yeah.
The third time, it wouldn't have got to a place where it became a problem, you know. So it's like you did it to yourself. Well, I didn't choose to be, you know, to have people dying in my front room. I didn't choose to, you know, to have girlfriends leave me when they gave me ultimatums. You know, either stop doing drugs or I'm gone. I didn't, you know, these weren't choices that I made, you know, or you know, jobs that were, you know, if you're late again. That's, you know, we're going to have to sack you. I didn't, these weren't choices that I made. I was kind of compelled to, you know, to use drugs or you know, whatever. So, yeah, I don't, I think, you know, around sort of stigma and stuff, I think there is one.
I mean, this is a bit more of a difficult question, but what do you think what should researchers be doing about this? What could people in the public eye be doing about this? And what could the general public do about this? Just an easy question.
If I knew the answer to that, I'd monetize it. Do you know what I mean? I think the simple thing is that, you know, if we treat addiction as a health issue, I mean, that's basic, you know. I mean, I'm totally abstinent, But I understand, you know, the idea of, you know, shooting galleries for people to use in, or giving them, you know, medical safe, heroin and stuff.
Safe injecting rooms for people who inject drugs.
I mean, my thing is that I just want to keep people alive. I can't help somebody, you know, get off drugs if they're dead, ultimately. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know, so my goal is to keep them alive and hopefully they'll get to a place where they maybe want to stop. And if they don't, that's fine. What, you know, it's whatever works for them. You know, I don't think that treating it as a criminal issue, I don't think that solves anything. I mean, you know, it didn't stop me. Getting arrested didn't stop me. What it did do was it stopped me working in certain jobs. It stopped me being able to travel to certain countries. You know, so the consequences of my drug use, you can think, right, I've got clean now. I'm not using drugs. I'm now time to, like, you know, get on with my life. And you kind of go, oh, no, I can't go for that job because
those
I've got...
doors are closed. Yeah.
You know, because of stuff that happened, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, however long, you know, you're left with the consequences of that. And I don't know any addict that didn't use because they might get into trouble with the police. I mean, you know, there's organisations like We Are The Loop, for example, that do all the sort of testing, you know, the front of the house testing at festivals and that. You know, Festival Republic that own Reading and Leeds and, you know, most of the big UK festivals won't allow them on site. And, you know, they had two deaths this year, you know, in the space of 2 days. I think both teenagers as well. They were, you know, young people. And, you know, the arguments that I read for, it encourages people to use drugs. It makes them think that the drugs are safe. I've bought drugs. I mean, I remember being on tour with Blur in like 2003, and I'd run out of drugs in Germany. We'd ended up in Paris, and I was like, I've got a score. So I found a bunch of kids on the corner near where we were from, like Senegal, and I've got my passport on me. I've got all my money. I've got everything on me. You know, I should have dashed it all at the venue and just come out with just a few quid. And then, you know, I'm in a taxi with these guys, you know, up an industrial estate, like scoring. I don't know what they gave me. It wasn't very good. Do you know, on reflection, you kind of, what do you expect? Do you know what I mean? You know, I'd done the same thing to them if they was in London. But didn't stop me. My thought was, look, it's not very strong. If I take lots of it, though, it might work. You know, it's like people don't do drugs because they don't know what's in it, or, you know, they just do it. Yeah. You know, and that's all. I mean, maybe that's just my experience. I don't know. So
I think it's quite reflective of what you see in people's behaviour in the real world, is that these kind of harm reduction measures, they might not help everyone, but if they reduce harm for the majority of people, then it's better than not doing anything at all.
You just want to keep people alive.
Exactly.
I mean, that's ultimately it. I mean, you know, the...
Well, and healthy, ideally.
Yeah.
As healthy as they can be.
They did it sort of like with Fabric, didn't they? You know, a couple of young boys died outside. And, you know, it's like we can't keep drugs out of prisons, but we expect people to keep drugs out of nightclubs, which I just think is mental. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know how that sort of double standard works, but, you know, it is what it is. And so these kind of things are they upped their security to get their license, and they had to have like extra dogs and, you know, police or something. You know, the presence of people, you know, around the door, to, you know, people coming in, so they don't bring drugs in. I'll just do all my drugs outside. That's what I would do.
Well, and that's what people...
I would just load up outside and go, right, well, I'll get in before it all goes wonky. Mm-hmm. Probably have to write off the first couple of hours, but I'll come out of it at 2 a.m. and be grand. You know, so it's like, and again, that's danger. That's when people start overdosing and stuff, you know. It's just, so yeah, so these kind of preventative measures are just nothing short of kind
well,
of insane.
Well, and what you've just described is the kind of unforeseen or potentially foreseeable, but unconsidered consequences that actually these kind of harm reduction measures, like putting increased security on doors, could actually increase the risk of harm inside because of people doing what you say, of taking everything that they've got before they go in and potentially getting into real problems once they're inside.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose that's the consequence of having people that I suppose weren't drug users, weren't... I mean, you haven't got to be an addict. Do you know what I mean? It's not even sort of, oh, you're an addict or you're a heavy drug. Just people who are kind of in and around that environment that, you know, have gone through it. You know, these people have no kind of lived experience. So these kind of opinions and these preventative measures they put in are just absolutely ridiculous to anyone that has any kind of experience of it. Do you know what I mean? As I say, the idea that I'm not going to do drugs because I don't know what's in it would just be like ridiculous. Of course I'm going to do it. I'll just take a little bit first, though.
See what it's like.
Yeah.
So this is a science podcast. So one of the things that I'm quite interested in is when you were using drugs, what did you think? I mean, you've just said that you weren't necessarily worried about what it was. If you were given something like a white powder or a pill, you'd probably take it and find out that way. But did you ever think about what the effects of drugs were in terms of, would that impact your likelihood to use? Or
no.
Did you think about like what different drugs have different effects? I guess you kind of talked about this with thinking about moving from one substance to another when you were worried that you were using one too much, you'd move to a different one. But did you ever think about kind of the evidence of the effects of drugs when you were doing them, or you just wanted something that was going to change your mental state?
When you say effects, do you mean like the physical long-term or mental long-term effects, or the effect in that moment?
Kind of both, I guess.
Not really. I mean, you know, I would... It ended up at the stage where, you know, I'd go out on... You know, I'd go to the nightclub down the end of the road, go to the pub, and, you know, my mate would be DJing, so we'd pop down or whatever. And I'd have maybe done 20 mils of Valium, smoked a couple of skunk joints and been drinking. And I'd be at the bar, like, sort of dribbling. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've had a stroke or something. So I would do drugs that maybe weren't appropriate to
the situation.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? So I were at a nightclub, so let's do loads of coke or let's do loads of ease. And, you know, you'd think the Valium would be for that'd be for home. Do you know what I mean? When you've got a good movie on or something, right? So, but yeah, I mean, there would be times we'd kind of go, right, well, this is going on. So, you know, there's like a movie marathon going on. So make sure I've got like a quarter of skunk and a bottle of red wine or a bottle of gin and, you know, that kind of thing. But, I mean, in terms of the long-term effects or the health implications, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. I mean, I think young people in general, I mean, maybe now it's slightly different, but I think young people in general aren't that concerned. You know, they don't think about death too much. I mean, maybe now they do because, you know, the earth's like going to fall apart. But in terms of their themselves, I've sat there after, you know, I've been up for days and I feel like my heart's about to explode and I'm still doing coke. I'm still, you know, still dropping E's. It's not been like I actually think I'm going to die. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, I'm not going to be dramatic. I don't know how close to death I possibly was. There's been times I've took myself up the hospital, you know, three or four times, maybe a couple more where I've been with people and it's like, I actually think I'm going to die. And I've had to go to the hospital. You know, the hospital was probably on the way home, so it wasn't like going out of my way. But, you know, it was like, you know, and I've took myself to A&E. And, you know, after... you know, 2 hours of waiting in the waiting room or whatever, I've got bored and gone home. But there's been moments where I'm like, I think I'm sort of, it's not stopped me though. Mm-hmm. In the next day, 2 days later, a week later, I'm, you know, straight back doing what I'm doing.
So to finish off, do you have any advice that you would give to, first of all, to young people who are thinking about using substances who haven't, and then to people who are worried about their substance use?
That's a, you know, without being sort of too preachy, I used to go into secondary schools and talk to kids, and I didn't want to be that sort of old guy. You know, I'm like 41 now. I don't want to be that old guy who rocks into school, you know, with big collars, trying to, you know, connect with the kids and be like cool, groovy, and sort of start using words that they use. Do you know what I mean? Right. You know, kids are going to do what they're going to do. And trying to tell a kid who's 15 that they shouldn't do drugs is, I think it's just ridiculous. You know, when I was 15, if someone had said that to me, and I'd be like, I'm having my first sex experiences. I'm having, you know, I got drunk the other night at this girl and she was drunk and, you know, I put my hand up at top and it was like the best night I've ever had in my life. Right. So, you know, do you know what I mean though? Right. So when these kids are kind of having these experiences and there's no consequences at that point, to tell them not to do, don't do drugs, just say no. It's ridiculous. And I think that as much as I love the just say no kind of narrative, I find it funny. Do you know what I mean? I've got, you know, If you remember the Dare to Resist Drugs and Violence, I got T-shirts with that stuff on. I was going to wear one today, but I thought, oh, no, she'll think I'm some sort of mad sort of anti-drugs campaigner, and that's not where I'm at, you know. So, but you know, I find all that stuff, and you know, I sometimes sit there on YouTube and watch all these kind of videos,
the fried egg,
yeah, all that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like the reefer madness, all that stuff. Right, it's absolutely nonsense, right? So, sort of trying to tell kids, you know, oh, don't do drugs or. So my kind of, the way I try and approach it when I was talking to lots of young people would be to say to them, you know what, if you're doing all your homework, you're fulfilling all your responsibilities during the week, and you're going and getting stoned with your mates on a Saturday night playing FIFA or whatever, that's fine. So, but if you're finding that you're turning up at school stoned, or you're getting stoned at lunchtime and you're unable to concentrate in the afternoon, or you start dropping stuff out, you know, whereas I'd be out with mates and I'd be like, oh, well, I want to go home and get stoned. I'd leave. It'd be, you know, perfectly fine where we were having fun. There were women, you know, there was whatever going on. And I'd like, well, I want to leave and go and get stoned on my own, or go and do drugs on my own. If you're finding that you're doing stuff like that, where it becomes slightly more important than everything else, or you know, you're starting to get paranoid, you think your girlfriend fancies your mate, some whatever madness is going on for you, if that stuff is starting to happen, maybe you want to look at you know how much you're smoking, how much you're drinking. Do you know what I mean? You know, maybe, you know, because for me, when it was sort of, you know, I grew up with a just say no stuff, it was like, just say no. If you know reefer madness, if you smoke a joint, you're going to go mad. I smoked a joint, giggled, and got off of a girl over Hampstead Heath. It was a fantastic experience. It was a fantastic experience. So if you're lying about that, what else are you lying about? So what about the heroin that you're saying is really bad? I'm not sure if I believe that now. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
it loses the credibility.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I try and sort of be honest and say, you know what, if you're gonna do drugs, then, you know, do what you're gonna do. But as I say, there are consequences. Do you know what I mean? You know, and consequences can be positive. My experience, there weren't many, especially towards the end of my drug use. You know, my brother's got drug-induced schizophrenia from smoking skunk, right? These are real consequences. Not everyone gets them, though. But I will inform you with as much information as possible so you can make the best choice for yourself. And also, as well, if you know that stuff, then when things start to go wrong, you're then maybe in a position to seek help. I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, I wanted help in 1998. Didn't get it. Didn't get my shit together till 2007. In that period, I lost jobs and burnt bridges and, you know, working in the music industry. I had multiple girlfriends. You know, I'd say they all left me. They didn't leave me. I pushed them away with my outrageous behaviour. I had people die. I had, you know, there was stuff that happened that I didn't need to experience. If only I'd known years earlier that, you know, what was wrong with me, what help was available. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, talk about in recovery, you got to hit a rock bottom. And I kind of agree with that. You have to, you know, because drugs are essentially fun, and also as well, you know, a coping mechanism and all this other stuff, right? That I'm not, when things start going wrong, the first thing I'm not going to do is stop. Yeah. That's not, oh, you know, you need to stop doing drugs. Like, no, it's the girlfriend, it's the boss, it's my dad, it's my mum, it's my situation. If you'd grown up how I'd grown up, then you would do what I did. It's everything else. Yeah. It's everything else, right? It was only until all that had been stripped away that I kind of accepted that the common denominator in all of these issues, all these problems that I have, is me, and that drugs are generally involved. You know, so maybe that's the problem, right? So you have to hit a rock bottom, but why does your bottom have to be stepping over someone that's overdosed and died? Why does it have to be being made homeless? Why does it have to, you know, why did it have to be me not having a relationship with my mum for 14 years before she died? Why did, you know, all these things that happened to me, it didn't have to be that. It could have just been the first job, first girlfriend, second girlfriend maybe, as opposed to the fifth or sixth. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So my thing is trying to raise the bottom. You know, so this stuff doesn't have to happen to you. So you know, after losing one or two jobs because of drug use, maybe like, maybe I do need to stop. As I said, as opposed to being like homeless on the streets or suicidal or, you know, whatever. So yeah, I try and talk to people and kind of, you know, inform them, because I just don't think fear works. It doesn't work. you know. And then once, like you said earlier, once you lose credibility, it's gone. Mm. Once you're known as a bullshitter,
no one's gonna
listen. It's done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And children especially are. You know,
they think that adults are
trying to fuck with their fun anyway. Do you know what I mean? So if you kind of end up somewhere in that area, you're just written off. Do you know what I mean?
It's ironic because we all were teenagers as well.
Yeah, you'd think we would know. You'd think we would know what is receptive to children, what they respond to. But unfortunately, it's like you get old and you forget. It's like, you know, suddenly all the music they listen to is rubbish. You're going to go, I'm sure my parents used to say that shit to me. Do you know what I mean? You know, and it's, yeah.
Well, pondering on our old age seems like a great place to finish this. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
And there we go. I'd like to thank The Secret Drug Addict again for taking the time to come and speak to me. Now, I know Say Why to Drugs is a science podcast, and perhaps some of you are wondering where the science was in this conversation. But as I said partway through the episode, I think that hearing the human stories behind the statistics is both important and quite powerful. If you like this episode and you'd be keen to hear more of these kinds of conversations, then please let me know. Do come along to some of the live events, as I said at the beginning. You can find details on my website, susiegage.co.uk. So far, there are events in London, Glasgow, Hexham and Oxford that have been announced, and there are many more in the pipeline. So I hope to meet some of you in person, and if not, see you next time, which will probably be the live event that's happening in London this very weekend. Bye!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.